1460 WVOX.
Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to The Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nina Lubin. And we're coming to you following our summer hiatus on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, courtesy of WVOX 1460 AM, and our very talented sound engineer, Gerald Bell. So, Nina, how are you this morning?
Hey, Tamar. I am, all things considered, doing just fine. I'm still seeing in my neighborhood and hearing from other localities about the continued outpouring of compassion and human-to-human contact and help following the devastation of Tropical Storm Ida, all without questions or comments about political party affiliations or who you voted for, who you didn't vote for, not drawing any conclusions, just noting that kindness lives on. So I think
well,
you have
a good way
some,
to start off the morning.
Well, I know.
You
have some words for us about the United States Constitution.
Absolutely. This Friday is Constitution Day, which is a national holiday commemorating the signing of the U.S. Constitution. It also celebrates those who have become American citizens, either through naturalization or coming of age. And it's commemorated every year on September 17th, and that date is the date in 1787 that the Constitution was actually signed. And as members of the League of Women Voters, we are recognizing Constitution Day, as we do each year, as the perfect time to celebrate the right to vote, which is obviously the very cornerstone of our citizenship. So for those listeners interested in registering to vote, the League's going to be holding voter registration drives this Friday from noon to 2 p.m. at Iona College, and that's open to anyone. And on Sunday, September 19th, from 11 to 5 p.m. at the New Rochelle Street Fair in front of New Rochelle City Hall. We welcome anyone interested in either registering to vote or helping us to register people to vote. Free training. It only takes 5 minutes. So, as I said, our show today is going to commemorate Constitution Day, and we have a very special guest who we're going to be introducing shortly. But before we do that, I just want to announce one other important upcoming League event to our listeners so they can mark their calendars. On October 14th, from 5:30 to 7:30, the League of Women Voters is going to present a program at Manhattanville College. This is an in-person program called Lies and Liberty, the Future of Free Speech in a Divided America. And Senior Vice President and Deputy General Counsel of the New York Times and author of Truth in Our Times, David E. McCaw, is going to provide what promises to be an illuminating discussion in the age of alternative facts. Andrew Cattell, news literacy trainer and retired Associated Press journalist, is going to moderate. So please join us for this in-person event. Once again, October 14th at 5:30 p.m. at Manhattanville College.
Listeners may recall that the moderator on October 14th, Andy Cattell, was a Ballot Box guest in November of last year, bringing his journalism background to bear on how to combat media disinformation. That show and a set of tools that Andy provided can be found on the New Rochelle League website. Thank you again, Andy, wherever you are this morning. Today, Tamar and I have the pleasure of hosting New York Times journalist, whose visit with us is independent of the October 14th event with The Times' David McCaw. We contacted Jesse Wegman, a Times editorial board member, after reading his August 4th column entitled, Thomas Jefferson Gave the Constitution 19 Years. Look Where We Are Now. So for the two of us, Tamar and Nina, the title was a big whoa, whoa. In the first place, what do you mean Jefferson gave the Constitution 19 years? And in the second place, yes, please, could someone who has done the research, knows the facts, and can speak knowledgeably, please tell us where, constitutionally speaking, the nation finds itself now? And who better to ask than the column's writer? Jesse Wegman, an NYU law school graduate, has worked as a reporter, editor, and producer at National Public Radio, The New York Observer, Reuters, and Newsweek, among other media outlets. Since 2013, he's been at The New York Times writing about legal affairs and the Supreme Court. So, done the research? Check. Knows the facts? Check. Can speak knowledgeably about the Supreme Court? Check. Jesse is also the author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College, published last year. The book contains clear, readable thoughts on the Electoral College for those who understand it and for those like me who do not. It presents a nonpartisan argument that speaks to Republicans and Democrats and everyone else, and that speaks to the nonpartisan League of Women Voters. So, Jesse Wegman, thank you for your time this morning, and welcome to the Ballot Box.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Delighted that you could make it. Tamar and I found your article to be a swift 3-credit course, especially for those of us who are not constitutional experts. A history lesson, a perspective on why the Supreme Court may be a too powerful branch of government, and a cautionary tale about the future of our democracy. So I'm going to open with open the discussion with this question, and we may need to stop for a break, but at least let me get it out there so you can think about it. Your column made the statement, you wrote, that those of us alive today may never witness another constitutional amendment in our lifetimes. And we'd like to kindly ask you to elaborate on that.
Sure. Well, you know, the reason that I decided to write this piece, and, you know, I was noting that we were approaching the 50th anniversary of the 26th Amendment, the amendment that extended the voting rights to 18-year-olds, everyone 18 and up. And I realized it's been, you know, 50 years since the last, you know, substantive amendment had been ratified. And I thought, wow, you know, that's a long stretch. And it also makes us ask the question, when are we going to have another constitutional amendment? We've had 27 so far. And, you know, the more I spoke to scholars and people who pay attention to this, constitutional historians, I became increasingly pessimistic that we ever would pass another amendment. There's obviously the exception of the Equal Rights Amendment, which I think we should talk about. But I really think, for many reasons that we can get into, where the country has gotten to politically is not compatible with ratifying another constitutional amendment in our lifetimes and perhaps well beyond.
Could you unpack that when you say where we are right now? Where are we? And why is that preventing a change?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the most obvious answer is the polarization that has really spread nationwide and has only deepened in the last few decades. I think there have always been parties in this country. There have always been, you know, factions. There have always been people who feel very strongly that the other side is, you know, treasonous or hateful. But, you know, I don't think there are a number of factors that make this partisanship and this polarization, I think, in some ways more entrenched and harder to break out of than previous iterations. And so I think that's the quick answer to why we can't approve the Constitution, why we can't amend the Constitution, and we can get into more shortly.
We will, after the break. Thank you very much. We'll be back shortly.
Let's return now to the Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, the Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, welcome back to the Ballot Box with our guest today, Jesse Wegman of the New York Times editorial board and a prolific watcher of the Supreme Court. We asked Jesse about his statement that those of us today may, in fact, never witness another constitutional amendment in our lifetimes, and Jesse started speaking about the great difficulty of getting an amendment through, even under the best of times. So please do continue.
Sure. Well, as you say, even under the best of times, the bar is extremely high to amend the Constitution. Any amendment requires, first, passage through both houses of Congress, two-thirds approval in both houses of Congress, which, try to imagine getting two-thirds of approval for anything in either house of Congress right now. I don't think we can. And that's only step one. Step two is then, if it passes two-thirds of both houses of Congress, the Senate and the House of Representatives, it then goes out to the states for ratification. And you need three-quarters of all states to ratify it. That's 38 states today. So you can see how the amount of national consensus required to amend the Constitution is really extremely high. And you have, that's why we've only seen 27 out of, I think, more than 11,000, nearly 12,000 now that have been proposed throughout American history. Only 27 have passed, and the first 10 of those, which we call the Bill of Rights, was essentially a package deal that was the price of ratification of the Constitution itself. You know, the Anti-Federalists, demanded the Bill of Rights be included and essentially said they weren't going to ratify, they were going to hold up ratification of the Constitution without that. So I put those 10 to the side, and then you really only have 17 throughout American history that have passed and been ratified. So I think that's important to remember, is that even under the best of conditions, it is extremely, extremely hard to pass an amendment to the Constitution. I wrote this whole book, you know, the one you mentioned about the Electoral College, Let the People Pick the President, about a whole section of that book is about the effort in the late 1960s and 1970s to amend the Constitution to switch to a national popular vote for president. And to eliminate the Electoral College. And what's amazing is, you know, we got as close as we possibly could have to doing that. You know, there was, the Congress, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed that amendment. 80% of Americans agreed that, you know, polls suggested more than 80% of Americans actually wanted a popular vote for president. The polling in the states suggested that they were very close to having the three-quarters of states on board that were necessary to ratify the amendment. And instead, what happened was the Senate, actually only a few members of the Senate, filibustered the amendment until it died on the floor in late 1970. And, you know, that was the last time we ever came close to, amending the Electoral College out of the Constitution. So that was a situation in which you had support all over the country. You had support from Republicans. You had support from Democrats. And even then, it couldn't get done. So I think it's a lesson in how hard this is. And that was at a time when polarization was nowhere near what it is today. So I think that was what led me, that and the sort of acknowledgement of the political reality of our time, as well as speaking to constitutional historians and legal scholars, led me to this, I think, pessimistic view that we are not likely to amend the Constitution again in any of our lifetimes.
And yet, you said in the book that the founders fully expected that the Constitution would be changed by the generations that followed, which, I mean, that stopped Nina and I dead in our tracks. I mean, it seems so critical to our nation's future, that the founders anticipated that there would be constitutional revisions in every generation. Can you tell us a little bit historically about that?
Absolutely.
Which founding fathers said what?
Yeah.
And when?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. The founders themselves were quite optimistic that, you know, they knew they knew that they had created this imperfect document that was full of errors, that was full of biases. They say this out loud many times around the time of the Constitutional Convention and the ratification. And, you know, this is, it's funny to listen to people today kind of treating them as these, you know, saints, these heroes who could do no wrong. They themselves had much lower opinions of themselves. And they knew that, you know, as the country grew and expanded and changed, it was going to need to adapt its founding charter to those changing times. And so I quote, you know, many of the founders in that article saying versions of this. James Wilson, who's arguably the most influential and most important framer of the Constitution of all, tells a crowd a few months after they signed the Constitution in 1787, he says, if there are errors, it should be remembered that the seeds of reformation are sown in the work itself. And, you know, Gouverneur Morris, who another extremely important founder, was writing to a friend some decades later about that summer of 1787 when they wrote the Constitution, and he wrote, surrounded by difficulties, we did the best we could, leaving it with those who should come after us to take counsel from experience and exercise prudently the power of amendment which we had provided. So, and then, of course, there's Thomas Jefferson, who you know, has his famous statement that no constitution should last longer than 19 years. He said, if it is enforced longer, it is an act of force, not of right. And I think, you know, obviously that was not a majority view, but that was the view that the Times headline writers pulled out, because I think a lot of people didn't know that Thomas Jefferson had taken that position. But it all goes to show that they really understood the Constitution to be a protean document, a document that would grow and change as the country did. And I think the reason that they did not see that as in conflict with setting such what we now today understand as such a high bar to amend the Constitution is that they said, you know, we're all in agreement here. We're all working together for the betterment of the country. They didn't understand there would be political parties.
Right.
And so once you had political parties, it all changes.
Right. Okay, Jesse, we will be back after this break.
Great.
Thank you.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back to The Ballot Box. We are speaking with Jesse Wegman, a New York Times editorial board and a close watcher of the Supreme Court and constitutional amendments. Jesse, I'd like to ask this going back to our previous discussion where the point was made that in the best of times, it's hard to amend the Constitution. And now we are seeing the other end of the spectrum, getting close to the worst of times, where polarization makes it exceptionally difficult to think about unanimity and compromise among our politicians. However, historical fact check, we have three amendments that were ratified quickly in a very polarized time, right after the Civil War, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. How were they able to do it then?
Under extreme duress. It was almost literally at the barrel of a gun. The states of the former Confederacy that had seceded and kicked off the Civil War were required to ratify the 14th Amendment as a condition of being readmitted to the Union. So this was not a choice. This was an offer they could not refuse, and that was why, you know, that's why we have, you know, the Reconstruction Amendments are obviously a central component of our constitutional law today and of our constitutional system, but I think people often forget that they were basically forced on the southern states. So, you know, that was one period of kind of intense constitutional reform. We've only had a few of them in our history. Amendments are scattered throughout American history, but there's just a few pockets, and that was one of them, the years immediately following the Civil War in the 1860s. The 1910s, we saw another push to get a bunch of amendments through, and then the last real push was in the 1960s, late 1960s, actually that entire decade, when I believe four amendments were passed in the span of a decade, which is sort of inconceivable today to do even one. They did four in the span of a decade. So, you know, yes, we have passed constitutional amendments at times of great political polarization, but there were extenuating circumstances.
Jesse, you touched briefly earlier in the show on the Equal Rights Amendment, and I'd like to circle back to that. You know, as League of Women Voters has been trying to get this on the agenda for so many years, can you please give us an update on where that stands and its prospects for the future?
Sure. So the ERA, you know, was around the proposal. The ERA itself says, you know, prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex. And it's been around, versions of it have been around for 100 years. But the actual amendment that we talk about today was introduced in the early 1970s, and it actually passed. It passed both houses of Congress with the help in the Senate of Birch Bayh, the senator from Indiana, who was also instrumental in passing attempting to pass that Electoral College amendment I discussed, and who was instrumental in passing the 26th Amendment, the amendment that extended the right to vote to 18-year-olds. So he was really central to a lot of these constitutional reform efforts at that time. The Equal Rights Amendment took a different course than either of those two, the Electoral College or the 18-year-old voters, because it did get approved by both houses of Congress, and then it went out to the states. And it quickly picked up several dozen states, but it did not reach the required minimum of 38. So Congress had put in, not in the language of the amendment itself, but in the proposing resolution that introduced the amendment, a time limit. I think it was a 7-year time limit. And when the 7 years was approaching the end, I think in the late 1970s, they were still short a handful of states, and they said, "Oh, let's there was still a real push to get this added to the Constitution. Equal rights was at the time a really salient political issue, and one that I think a lot of people felt especially strongly about. And so they extended the deadline several years into the early 1980s. No more states joined. So, you know, it just kind of sat there unratified, about, I think it was three states short. It was at 35 then. And then in the late 2010s, I think largely probably spurred on by the election of Donald Trump, there was a new attention was brought to that issue, and several states brought it back up again and did ratify it. They said, "We disregard the time limit. We're going to pass it anyway." And I think it was early last year that Virginia became the 38th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. So, you know, I think there is a strong argument that the Equal Rights Amendment is, by all rights, already part of the Constitution. It is the 28th Amendment to the Constitution. I, in my piece that we've been discussing, I was sort of dismissive of it, and I think maybe I was a little too quick to, the point I was trying to make was, I don't think the ERA is going to be admitted, is going to be ratified and included officially as part of the Constitution, but I think there's actually quite a good legal argument that it should be, and that, in fact, Congress does not have the power to set time limits on the ratification process. The Article 5, which gives Congress one of the paths through Article 5 to amending the Constitution, is, you know, Congress introducing an amendment and passing it through both houses. It includes no mention of time limits. And indeed, the 27th Amendment, which passed in the early 1990s after the amendment that I wrote this piece about, the 26th Amendment on voting, 18-year-olds voting. The 27th Amendment was actually written by James Madison, and it was originally part of what we now call the Bill of Rights. It was an amendment that nobody gave much thought to for many years after, which was about when Congress could raise its own pay. It was, like the ERA, close to ratification, but not quite there. And then I think it was in the 1980s, somebody, a student in Texas realized, we could revive this amendment and we could pass it again. It did not include any language about a time limit. And so the necessary states started adopting it, and it hit 38 states in 1992, and it became part of our Constitution. So that kind of undermines the argument that Congress could ever set any kind of time limit for passing for passing an amendment. And the other argument against the ERA that says, you know, for people who say this cannot ever be a part of the Constitution, is that several of the states that ratified the ERA in the 1970s later rescinded their ratification. The a new political party took power in those states and decided, oh, we don't like that we ratified this amendment. We're going to revoke our previous ratification. The problem with that is that I think that was five states that have done that. And so the argument is, oh, well, even if you've hit 38 states, the necessary minimum, you actually are at 33 states because those five states have revoked. The argument against that is, and I think this is also a strong argument, is that no state revocation of its own ratification of an amendment has ever been accepted in American history. So states have tried to revoke in other cases on other amendments before, and those revocations have never been recognized. So I think you can make a good argument, and many legal scholars do, that those five states have actually not revoked their ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, that in fact that ratification is still good. So, I think there is a strong argument that the ERA is and should be a part of the Constitution, but, you know, in order for that to happen, the archivist of the United States, who is the last official figure to literally ratify all of the decisions of Congress and the states and put the and say that the document officially is now part of the Constitution, has not done that. And he is refusing to do that until a court orders him to. And so I think we would be going through a lot of litigation. There is litigation right now, and I'm not going to guess how that litigation would turn out, but I'm not terribly optimistic given the makeup of our courts and of the Supreme Court today.
So 100 years after women get the vote, we still don't have guaranteed equal treatment
and
under the Constitution.
And I just want to make clear, I strongly support the Equal Rights Amendment. I think it should be a part of the Constitution, but I'm just not too optimistic on it happening this time.
Okay. Thank you, Jesse. We will be back after this break.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. Nina and I were speaking this hour with Jesse Wegman, New York Times editorial board member and author of Let the People Pick the President, the case for abolishing the Electoral College. Before the break, Jesse was speaking to us about the Equal Rights Amendment, and it's just one of many proposed amendments over the years. There have been so many. Jesse, I think you said around 1,000 or so?
12,000.
12,000. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so 12,000, and they've run the gamut from abolishing the Electoral College, ending the Senate's filibuster, reforming campaign finance and lobbying limits, establishing fixed terms for Supreme Court justices. There's so many. Can you, Jesse, please share your thoughts on which amendments do you think are actually the most compelling in terms of maintaining a robust representative democracy?
You know, I think right now, as we're watching this multi-pronged assault play out on voting across the country by Republican lawmakers, I do think that voting rights and a sort of instantiation of voting rights in the document itself, in the Constitution, would do more than anything, both practically but also symbolically, to protect and preserve and strengthen American democracy. So, you know, one thing that I've written about and that many others have pointed out over the years is that there is no actual affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. There wasn't at the founding, and none of the amendments expanding voting to other groups of people, like former enslaved people and women, none of those are written in the affirmative. They're written in the negative. They say shall not be, you know, prohibited, or that the right to vote shall not be prohibited. And so I think an affirmative statement that says, you know, the right to vote for all, you know, that guarantees the right to vote for all people 18 and older. I think some have made an argument that you could go younger than 18. And I think that there's a lot of power to that argument too, but that it should be in the affirmative. It should be out in the open. And that there are other ways in which voting rights and representation more generally can be strengthened to the benefit of democracy. So, you know, banning partisan gerrymandering, for example, that to me is a crucial, that's a huge problem. It's as big a problem as the malapportionment that gave us the one person, one vote rulings back in the 1960s. And that one person, one vote ruling, there was a series of rulings in the early 1960s, were just so essential to actually vindicating the fundamental premise of the Constitution, which was that, and of the Declaration of Independence, which is that we are all created equal. We are all equal, political equals, when we come to the ballot box. And I think that's an essential element of this country, and it is essential to keep it front and center if the country is going to survive as a modern representative democracy. So those two right there, an affirmative right to vote, and which I think would actually could have a lot of ripple effect down the road for state laws, and a ban on partisan gerrymandering would really go a long way toward helping to ensure that the country, that people could vote, and that their votes would actually be translated into leadership that they wanted. So you wouldn't have minorities of the population picking majorities of their legislatures, as currently happens in a number of states like Wisconsin and North Carolina. So right there, I think that to me would be, those would be the top options.
And yet we're seeing the opposite actually happen. Many states are constricting people's right to vote. Right to their vote, especially in a lot of the southern states at the moment. There are a lot of measures to take people's right to vote away from them. So it seems like it's not likely to actually gain any traction going forward.
Well, that's the problem, is when you have, right now, it's Republican leaders in Congress and in the state governments that are doing this. And the reason that they're doing it is because the incentives are there to do it, right? There's nothing blocking them from doing it. The Supreme Court has refused to step in and regulate partisan gerrymandering or outlaw it completely, which I think was a huge mistake, because there's nothing that voters can do otherwise. There's nowhere else they can turn. If lawmakers draw maps that essentially eliminate or invalidate the votes of millions of their voters, there's nowhere for those voters to turn other than the courts. And, you know, the Supreme Court in the 1960s recognized this with the one person, one vote rulings, which were a response to a very similar behavior by lawmakers around the country, which was the drawing of districts in a way that essentially, erased millions of voters. So that's why they established the one person, one vote principle, that everyone had a right to equal representation. You have the same problem right now with partisan gerrymandering, and yet this court, I think, because it is ideologically very distinct from the court in the 1960s, has decided we are not going to step in, basically leaving the voters to their own devices. And there's nothing voters can do about it. They're in an impossible situation. So, yes, I think when you have all the incentives pushing in favor of people keeping themselves in power, regardless of what their level of support is in the public, you are moving further and further away from the basic principle of representative democracy and one person, one vote that I think undergirds the nation. And I think it's a very dangerous path to go down and one that's hard to come back from.
And Jesse, where does the Electoral College fit into all of this? And be forewarned, about 3 minutes is left in
the
show.
Well, the Electoral College is just a great example of, you know, a system that was adopted by people who lived in an extremely different time, and has been used in such a way as to give way too much power to the to the majority parties in the states. So every state but two now gives all of its electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote in that state and zero to the loser, even if the popular vote total is 51-49. So what that ends up doing is, that's not in the Constitution, by the way. That's just something, a state rule that they've chosen. They don't have to choose that. So you don't need to actually amend the Electoral College out of the Constitution to change the way we choose the president. That's the topic of my book. But, you know, it goes to show that the design of our Constitution was, you know, it was done by only by white men, with property owning white men, slave owning white men in many cases, who had very different ideas about what the country was and what the country would be. And, you know, if we're going to have a constitution that works for the 21st century and for America in the 21st century, we're going to need to update and change many of the things about it, like the Electoral College, that I think serve to continue to keep people basically powerless or unrepresented. So I would, you know, I'm not advocating strongly for an amendment to abolish the Electoral College, just because I think there are other ways to get at what is effectively a popular vote for president. But I do see the Electoral College as one of the prime examples of a constitution written at a time when equality was not, political equality was not the central guiding principle of American politics.
When you say there's other ways, are you referring to the National Popular Vote Compact? And maybe you could talk a little bit about what that is and explain it to us in greater detail.
I'll just, I recognize time is short, so I'll just say very quickly, as I said, states can choose, they have the authority under the Constitution to choose for themselves how to award their electoral votes. There's almost no limitation on how they can do it. And what 48 of the 50 states have chosen to do is to do what we call winner-take-all. And that just means they give all of their electoral votes to the candidate who wins the most popular votes in their state and zero to the candidate who doesn't. And that just completely distorts what the American politics looks like. So millions of Republicans in California are essentially erased because, you know, California gives all 55 of its electoral votes to the Democrat. And the same thing happens in the reverse in Texas. 38 electoral votes go to the Republican, even though millions of Democrats in Texas voted for the Democrat. So it's really, I think, a harmful way to run a popular an election for the leader of the whole country. And there is a movement afoot to get states to agree with each other to change their state laws to award all of their electoral votes to the winner of the candidate who wins the most votes in the entire country, which would effectively, it would not eliminate the Electoral College from the Constitution, but it would effectively mean that the winner of the national popular vote becomes president. And that, I think, is the goal that so many of us have been working towards. So that's an effort that is well underway. I think there are now 15 or 16 states that are members of this agreement. And once they reach 270 electoral votes of states, which is 270 is what you need to become president, it then kicks in and those states automatically would give their electoral votes to the national popular vote winner. It's a really clever and interesting idea. I think there's challenges to it, obviously, that have come up and will continue to come up. But if you want to learn more about that, you can go read my book.
Thank you.
Sort of an end run around the constitutional amendment process.
I wouldn't call it an end run. I would call it using the Constitution precisely as it's written by the founders, which is to give the states the power to decide how to award their electoral votes. That's what they do right now, and that's what this National Popular Vote Compact does. It gives them it recognizes their power to choose how to award their electors, and it uses that power in a different way.
Okay, right. Thank you, Jesse Wegman, for a bit of a course. Historical and current situation as far as amending the Constitution goes. Hope to have you back again for a little bit more detail, especially about the Electoral College. Thank you. Would love to, anytime.
Thank you.
Great. Join us next Ballot Box on Wednesday, October 20th at 9, and to all have a very good day.
Thanks for listening.
AM 1460 WVOX New Rochelle.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people.
Coming up on the Media Project, an analysis of what's gone on in the news media in the past week. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Mayo, Ira Fussfeld, and me, Rex Smith. ivermectin in the media? Is it really just horse paste, or is there something that we ought to be paying attention to? We'll look at how newsrooms